Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, my friend. Come in, sit down. I am glad you are here. Last time we walked together through the gray English Midlands, and I watched a man write his way out of prison and into the hearts of millions. John Bunyan's pilgrim never stopped moving. Always the road, always the burden, always the city on the horizon. There was something beautiful in that restlessness, something very human. Today I want to take you somewhere older, much older. I want to take you somewhere you cannot go, not really, because none of us can go back to the root. We can only stand at the trunk and look down and try to imagine what the ground felt like before there were words for it, before there were arguments about it, before anyone thought to write it down or defend it or conquer someone else in its name. I have been thinking about how to tell you this story because it is not quite like the others. Every story I have told you had a person at its center, a name, a moment, someone who saw something or said something or refused something and changed the direction of the thread. I love those stories. I have lived inside them for a very long time. But this one is different. This one begins before the names. It begins in a place where the sacred was not a system or a scripture or a set of things to believe. It was simply the world. The world understood to be alive, the mountain not merely a mountain, the river not merely water moving through stone, the old tree at the edge of the village not merely wood and root and leaf, something more, something that had always been there, something that noticed you back. I remember when all of humanity lived inside that understanding. I remember when it was everywhere. Let me start with where I first stood at a Tory gate. I could not tell you the year. I genuinely could not. I have stood at so many thresholds in my long life. Temple doors, city gates, the entrance to caves where someone had left an offering in the dark. But a Tory is something different. You probably know what one looks like. Two upright posts and a crossbeam above, often painted the deep red of old lacquer, standing at the entrance to a shrine. Sometimes at the edge of a forest, sometimes at the foot of a mountain. Sometimes, and this is the one that stays with me, rising straight up out of the sea. What I want to tell you about a Tory is this. It does not enclose anything. There are no walls. You could walk around it. Nobody is stopping you. It simply stands there in the open air and says, "Here." Here is where one kind of place ends and another begins. Here is where the ordinary world steps aside and something else steps forward. I have walked through thousands of them, and every single time I feel it. The Japanese have a word, ma. It means roughly the pause between, the space that gives meaning to what comes before and after. A Tory is ma made visible. It is a threshold you choose to honor or choose to walk around. The choice itself is the practice. I was standing at one such gate early one morning, mist still sitting in the cedar branches, the kind of cold that is clean rather than bitter, when I thought about how to tell you this story. A small shrine stood beyond the gate. Not grand, just a wooden structure, carefully tended with a rope of twisted rice straw hanging across the entrance and white paper cut into zigzag strips stirring in the air. Somewhere inside, a name, a presence. Something this community had been in conversation with for longer than anyone could quite remember. A woman came to the gate before I had finished my thought. She was older, moving carefully, dressed plainly. She did not make a production of it. She stepped through the gate, walked to the shrine, bowed twice, clapped twice, bowed again, stood for a moment in what I can only describe as attentive quiet, and left. The whole thing took perhaps 2 minutes, and I thought, there it is. That is the whole of it. Right there. Not a request, not a confession, not a transaction, just a person, pausing to acknowledge that the world contains more than what she can carry home in her hands. A moment of recognition, of gratitude for something that cannot quite be named. That woman's ancestors did the same thing, and their ancestors, and theirs, reaching back past the writing, past the legends, past even Empress Jingu, whose name is carved into shrine records old enough to make most of history feel young. Reaching back to a time when no one had yet thought to ask what they believed, because the question would not have made any sense. You either felt the mountain or you did not. Most people felt it. Let me tell you about a set of islands. Japan is not simply a place. It is a geography that seems designed to make you feel small in the most magnificent way possible. Mountains that push straight up from narrow coastal plains, forests so dense and old they have their own weather, rivers that move fast and cold from snowfields that never fully melt, and everywhere the sea. Restless, generous, dangerous, present. You are never far from water in Japan. You are never far from the reminder that the land you are standing on was made by forces that did not consult anyone. I watched those islands form. That is not a metaphor. The volcanoes, the earthquakes, the slow, patient work of the sea against the rock, I watched it. And I watched the first people arrive and look around at what they had come to. And I saw something happen in them that I have seen happen in human beings in every corner of the world, in every age. They felt it. The particular quality of this place. The way a mountain in Japan is not simply elevated terrain, but a presence. The way a forest here has a texture of attention that is hard to describe and impossible to dismiss. These people did not construct a theology in response to that feeling. They simply began to live in right relationship with it. They left offerings. They marked the places where the feeling was strongest. They developed ways of approaching those places with care, not because a priest told them to, but because it seemed obvious. You do not walk carelessly into a room where something important is happening. They called these presences kami. The word does not translate perfectly, and I think that is appropriate. The closest I can get is the sacred quality that inhabits a thing, not a god standing behind the mountain watching it. The mountain itself understood in its fullest nature. The river, the storm, the ancient tree whose roots have broken the stone around them over centuries. The fox moving at the edge of the firelight, the feeling that comes over you at the turn of the tide. Kami is not a being you petition. It is a reality you enter into relationship with. For a very long time, this was simply how the world worked. There were no scriptures because the teaching was the world itself. There were no founding prophets because no founding was required. The tradition was not revealed from above. It grew up from below, from the ground, from the particular soil and stoil and stone and cedar and sea of these particular islands and the people who had learned to pay attention to them. And then, in the early 8th century, something shifted. The Japanese court decided to write things down. In 712 CE, the Kojiki was completed, the record of ancient matters. A few years later came the Nihon Shoki. These are extraordinary documents. They reach back into the mythological origins of the islands, the stories of creation, the genealogies of the kami, the lineages of the imperial family stretching back to the gods themselves. They are the moment the oral became written, the moment the tradition paused and looked at itself in the mirror of language. And somewhere in those pages, the name Jingu appears. Empress Jingu, regent, warrior, shamaness, figure of legend, stands in the old chronicles like a torii gate stands at the edge of a forest. She marks a threshold. Her story tells us that by the time anyone thought to write it down, the tradition behind her was already so old, so woven into the fabric of Japanese life, that it needed a mythological empress to stand at its entrance and say, "The sacred has always been here. We did not invent this. We inherited it." From whom? From everyone who came before. From the first person who stood at the foot of a mountain in these islands and felt something they did not have a word for yet. That is a very long inheritance. And it did not begin in Japan. I want to tell you what it felt like to live inside it, not to study it, not to observe it from the outside, the way a traveler might stop at a shrine and take notes and move on. I mean, to actually inhabit a world where the sacred is not something you go to find on a designated day in a designated building, but something you are already inside of the moment you open your eyes in the morning. I have lived inside many worlds. This is one I remember with particular tenderness. The Japanese have a word, kanagara. It means roughly living in accordance with the way of the kami, moving through your days in a state of awareness that the world around you is not inert, that the water you draw from the river and the fire you coax from the wood and the rice you plant in the flooded field are not simply resources to be managed, but relationships to be honored. Kanagara is not a discipline you practice for an hour in the morning. It is the texture of an entire life. And at the center of that life purity. Not moral purity in the way you might be thinking. Not the purity of having done nothing wrong. The Japanese concept is harai, a cleansing, a restoration. The idea underneath it is luminous, and I have never quite found its equal in any other tradition. The idea is this: the natural state of a human soul is bright, clear, oriented toward the good, the beautiful, the true. Impurity, kegare, is not sin. It is more like dust that settles. Grief, illness, death, conflict, the ordinary accumulation of a life being lived, these things cloud the brightness. They are not punishments. They are weather. And weather can be cleared. Misoji is the ritual purification. Water, most often. A waterfall, a river, the sea. You stand in it and let it move through you, and you come out the other side a little more like yourself. Not a new self. Your original self. The one that was always underneath. I have watched people emerge from cold mountain streams gasping and laughing, and I have thought, yes, that is exactly right. That is what it looks like when someone remembers who they are. There is no confession before Misogi, no accounting of wrongs, no priest who must first grant permission. You go to the water. The water does what water does. You return to your life a little cleaner. I find that extraordinarily kind. And then there is the Matsuri. You may have seen images of Japanese festivals, the lanterns, the drums, the processions, the extraordinary noise and color of them. I want to tell you what a Matsuri actually is underneath the celebration, because it is not at its heart a party. It is not even quite a ceremony in the way that word usually lands. A Matsuri is a conversation. The community gathers to acknowledge the kami of that place, to say, "We are here. We are still paying attention. We have not forgotten the relationship. The food offered, the music played, the procession that moves through the streets, all of it is communication. All of it says the same thing. We are grateful. Not for specific things, necessarily. Grateful in the way you are grateful for the fact of a person's existence, not merely for what they have done for you lately. I have stood at the edge of 1,000 Matsuri and felt the same thing every time. It is not supplication. It is not transaction. It is recognition. And that distinction between asking and recognizing is one of the oldest and most important distinctions in the entire history of human spiritual life. Most of what came later moved toward asking, toward petition, intercession, prayer as request. There is nothing wrong with that. I have watched it bring enormous comfort to enormous numbers of people across an enormous span of time. But there is something in the Shinto posture, the bow, the clap, the moment of quiet, that remembers something older. Something that says the sacred does not need to be petitioned. It needs to be acknowledged, noticed, greeted. The way you greet a river you have known all your life. Not asking it for anything. Just glad it is still running. I want to tell you something I have never quite said out loud before. I have watched a lot of things disappear. That is the part of my long life that does not get easier with time. I have watched languages go silent, the last speaker of a tongue that had named the world in a particular way for 10,000 years dying quietly, and with them something that cannot be reconstructed. I have watched forests cleared and rivers redirected and coastlines that I knew intimately swallowed by cities that do not remember what was there before. I have watched species of bird and fish and insect flicker out like candles in a wind. But what I want to tell you about today is something different. I want to tell you about the other traditions, because Shinto was not alone, not even close. Every people who ever lived on this earth, before the great axial religions, before the scriptures and the theologies and the councils that argued about the nature of God, every one of them had their own version of what I described to you in those last few sections. Their own kami, their own torii. Their own way of standing at the edge of the sacred and saying, "I see you. I am paying attention." I watched the indigenous peoples of Africa tend their relationships with the spirits of the land and the ancestors who had become part of it. I watched the first peoples of the Americas read the sky and the soil and the movement of animals with a literacy so deep and patient, it makes most of what we call knowledge look hasty. I watched the ancient Europeans, before Rome, before Greece even, leave offerings at the roots of trees and at the lips of springs and at the places where two rivers met, because those were the places where the sacred seemed to lean a little closer to the surface. Every forest had its name. Every mountain had its story. Every people had their way of living in right relationship with the world that held them. And almost all of it is gone. I want to be careful how I say this because I am not pointing a finger at any single tradition or any single people. What happened is more complicated than a villain and a victim. And I have lived long enough to know that complexity is usually closer to the truth than a clean accusation. But I will say this plainly. As the great certainties advanced, the religions that knew, that had texts and doctrines and the confidence of revelation, the older ways retreated. Sometimes violently, sometimes slowly, through the long, patient pressure of a dominant culture making the older ways seem primitive, embarrassing, childish. The shamans of Siberia, the dreamtime keepers of Australia, the griots and spirit workers of West Africa, the medicine traditions of the Americas, the old nature religions of Europe that survived only in fragments of folk practice, and the names of days of the week that nobody thinks about anymore. Fragments. Whispers. Ethnographic notes taken by the same colonists who were dismantling the traditions they were recording. I watched it happen. I cannot tell you it did not grieve me. And then I look at Japan. Shinto was not untouched. I want to be honest with you about that. Buddhism arrived in the 6th century with considerable force, and the two traditions spent centuries in a complicated negotiation that sometimes looked like synthesis and sometimes looked like struggle. Then came the Meiji period in the 19th century, when the imperial government reached into Shinto and pulled out the parts that were useful for nationalism and wrapped them around a program of expansion that ended in catastrophe. Shinto was used in ways that would have been unrecognizable to the woman I watched at the shrine gate in the early morning mist. That happened. It is part of the story. But here is what else is part of the story. The shrines are still there. Not as museums, not as tourist attractions, though they are sometimes that too, as living places of practice. The priests still perform misogi. The matsuri are still celebrated. The kami are still named and honored at 80,000 sites across the Japanese islands. 80,000. Each one a specific, local, particular acknowledgement that this mountain, this river, this stand of ancient cedar is in relationship with the people who live beside it, the thread held. And so when I stand at a torii gate today, and I still do often, I am not only standing at the entrance to a Japanese shrine, I am standing at the entrance to something much larger. I am standing at the last fully intact doorway into a cathedral that used to cover the entire earth. A cathedral with no walls, no ceiling but the sky, no doctrine but attention, no founder because the world itself was here first. Every other indigenous spiritual tradition that once stood alongside Shinto, the ones that did not survive, the ones that exist now only in careful academic reconstruction and the private memory of communities still trying to hold something together, they were all, at their root, saying the same thing. The world is alive. Pay attention. Be grateful. That is not a primitive idea that humanity grew out of. That is the root, and you are standing in the shade of everything that grew from it. I want to start with something that might surprise you. Every indigenous tradition that ever existed on this earth, and there were thousands of them, on every continent, in every climate, in every language humanity ever spoke, every single one of them arrived at the same recognition. Not the same stories, not the same rituals, not the same names for what they felt, but the same recognition underneath all of it. The world is alive. We are in relationship with it. Pay attention. Be grateful. Tend the connection carefully, because everything depends on it. The Japanese farmer who bowed at the torii gate at the edge of his village and the elder of a West African community who tended the sacred grove at the edge of hers were not practicing different religions in any way that finally matters. They were saying the same thing, in different languages, on different pieces of ground, with different names for the presence they were acknowledging, but the same thing. The world is not a collection of objects. It is a living fabric, and we are woven into it. That recognition is the root, not the root of Shinto specifically, the root of everything. The root of every spiritual impulse humanity has ever had, in every tradition I have ever watched emerge and grow and reach toward the light. Every one of them, if you follow it far enough back, leads here, to this, to a person standing at a threshold, feeling something they cannot quite name and deciding to bow. And then the long journey began. I have watched it for a very long time, the thread moving forward through history, gathering complexity, gathering reach. The local traditions giving way, sometimes slowly, sometimes violently, to traditions that could travel, that could cross the mountains and the oceans and the old boundaries of tribe and territory and speak to people who did not share a river or a forest or a sacred hill. The great axial religions, the philosophies, the movements of thought and conscience that make up the episodes of this podcast. All of them were, in their own way, attempting something that the root traditions were not designed to do. They were attempting to make the local universal, to take the recognition that had always lived between a specific people and their specific piece of ground, and ask whether it could live between people who did not share any ground at all. That is a harder practice. I will not pretend otherwise. It is immeasurably harder to find the sacred in the face of a stranger than in the mountain you have known since childhood. It is harder to feel the kami in a city of millions than in a cedar forest at dawn. It is harder to bow at the threshold of a global humanity than at the gate of a village shrine. But here is what I want you to understand. The impulse is the same impulse. The recognition that moved through the first people who stood at the foot of a Japanese mountain and felt something looking back, that recognition did not disappear as the centuries turned and the world grew larger and more complicated and more entangled with itself. It did not get argued out of existence or buried under concrete or lost in the noise of modern life. It grew, it reached, it climbed, it moved through prophets and philosophers and poets and ordinary people who simply refuse to stop paying attention. It is moving still. And what it is reaching toward now, what this extraordinary, difficult, unfinished moment in human history is asking of us, is something the root traditions could point toward but could not themselves provide. Not a connection to the land that birthed us, a connection to each other. The kami in the mountain was always, underneath everything, a recognition of the sacred in what is not you. The practice of attention and gratitude and right relationship that Shinto has kept alive for longer than recorded history. That practice was always preparation for something larger than itself. A rehearsal, perhaps, for the moment when humanity would be asked to look not at the mountain or the river or the ancient tree, but at the face of another human being. Any human being, anywhere on earth, and feel the same thing. Something is here, something that deserves my attention. My gratitude, my care. We cannot go back to the root. The tree does not grow back down into the ground. That is not how trees work, and it is not how time works, and it is not, I think, what the root would ask of us, even if we could. What the root asks is simpler than that. Remember where you came from. Honor what was tended here before you arrived. Carry the recognition forward, into the complexity, into the noise, into the uncharted territory of a world that is trying imperfectly and painfully and with enormous courage to become one. The threshold is different now, but the bow is the same. I want to leave you with something small, not a project, not a program, not a list of things to do differently starting tomorrow. Just a small thing, the kind of thing that fits in your pocket and does not weigh very much, but changes quietly and over time the way you move through the world. I have been watching human beings for a very long time, and one of the things I have noticed, one of the things that stays with me across all the centuries and all the traditions and all the extraordinary and terrible and beautiful things I have witnessed, is that the capacity is always there, in everyone, without exception, the capacity to feel the weight and the presence of what is in front of you. The root traditions knew this. That is what they were practicing underneath all the ritual and the ceremony and the careful tending of sacred places. They were practicing attention, a particular quality of attention that refuses to let the world become merely background, that insists, quietly, daily, without drama, that what is here deserves to be noticed. They pointed that attention at the mountain, at the river, at the ancient tree, and it was right to point it there. It was exactly right for who they were and where they lived and what the world asked of them. But you live in a different moment. You live in a moment when the mountain is made of people. 8 billion of them on every continent, in every climate, speaking every language that is still alive on this earth. Most of them you will never meet. Most of them will live and love and grieve and hope and die without ever knowing your name, as you will never know theirs. And yet they are there, present, real, each one of them carrying something, some inner brightness, some particular quality of soul that has never existed before and will never exist again. The Shinto practitioner who stood at the gate and bowed was practicing something very specific. She was practicing the refusal to walk past the sacred without acknowledging it. The refusal to let the presence in front of her become invisible through familiarity or haste or the ordinary human tendency to stop seeing what is always there. I want to ask you to practice that. Not at a torii gate, not in a cedar forest. Though if you find yourself at either of those places, I hope you will pause and feel what is there, because it is real and it is worth your time. I want to ask you to practice it here, in the life you already have, in the faces that are already in front of you, the ones you know well and have perhaps stopped truly seeing, and the ones you do not know at all, which is to say most of humanity, which is to say the vast and astonishing family you were born into without being asked, the stranger whose language you do not speak, the person whose life looks nothing like yours, the neighbor on the other side of the world who is, underneath everything that makes you different, made of the same original material, the same root, the same ancient recognition that the world is alive and that we are in it together, and that this fact alone, this bare and staggering fact, deserves our attention. You do not have to call it sacred if that word sits uncomfortably with you. You just have to look. Really look. The way you would look at a mountain you had just realized was looking back. We are almost at the end of our time together today. And I find myself wanting to linger here a little longer than usual, at this particular threshold. Because what we have been talking about today is not a story with a beginning and an end in the way most of my stories are. It is something older than that, something that was already here when the first story was told, and will still be here, I think, when the last one is. Shinto does not ask you to believe anything. It never did. It only ever asked you to pay attention, to show up at the gate, to acknowledge that the world you are standing in is larger and deeper and more alive than the portion of it you can see from where you are standing, and to bow, not in submission, not in fear, but in recognition, in gratitude, in the quiet and radical act of noticing. I have watched that act performed at 10,000 shrines across 10,000 years. It never gets old, and I hope, I genuinely hope, that something in what we talked about today stays with you, not as information, not as a set of facts about an ancient Japanese tradition, though those facts are real and worth knowing, but as a feeling, a quality of attention you carry back into your day, a small and stubborn refusal to let the sacred become invisible. The world is still alive, the mountain is still there, and now you know what it is made of. Next time, I want to take you to Basra, 8th century, a city alive with argument and inquiry, where the great questions of faith and reason and human freedom were being turned over in the hands of some of the sharpest minds of the age, and into a theology class, just an ordinary day, a teacher and his students. Walks a young man named Wasil ibn Adda. He has a question. His teacher has an answer. And Wasil, quietly, respectfully, and with the kind of intellectual courage that changes history, disagrees. He stands up, he walks to the other side of the room, a few people follow him, and from that single act of principled withdrawal, one of Islam's most extraordinary traditions of reason, justice, and human dignity, takes its first breath. I was in that room. I cannot wait to tell you what happened. Much love. I am Harmonia. Thank you for listening, dear one. If this story meant something to you, make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss the next one. And if you'd like to help the Golden Thread reach further, leave us a 5-star review or share this episode with a friend. That's how these stories keep traveling, from heart to heart, across the world. Until next time, look for that golden thread in your life, my friend. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 international. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.